find myself more enamored of these talking rather than writing these days. And so today I want to talk about this documentary that was on Netflix. It's on Netflix, called The Great Hack. I don't know what propelled me to watch it. I think maybe, you know, sometimes it's good to dip one's toes into how issues are being framed. And, you know, not to my surprise at all, but much to my dismay, the framing of the issues around data and privacy in this film were so obvious and silly, and it's all set up as a red herring. They're all avoiding all the institutional, the true institutional critique, and it really says something about the state of critique, and actually made me think about investigative journalism. And I've always sort of wondered about why journalism it's always focused on a circumstance. I could never understand why I didn't read articles about, capitalism gutting the planet, a structural violence eviscerating the poor of their rights to live. There's always a particular thing. There's always a whistleblower. There's always a particular institution. There's always, BP is a problem for the oil spilling in the Gulf. In the case of this movie, The Great Hack, Cambridge Analytica is set up as the fall guy, maybe complicit with Facebook. But nobody talks about the structures that allow these things to take place. And so what happens is, we take down Cambridge Analytica and we feel like something's been accomplished. And then we try to slap some fines on Facebook and we feel like we've done something. And that's what, a lot of that film focuses on this one journalist who thinks she's uncovering the big issue. But by focusing on Cambridge Analytica and mining their emails and emails between them and Facebook, and she is part of the ideology that is keeping us fundamentally enslaved, and it's so frustrating because there's a sanctimony and a pride in this kind of investigative journalism, but that sort of masks its its enormous blind spot to institutional environmental in Marshall McLuhan said environmental critique. That's a phrase from Marshall McLuhan. For him, an environment is the sort of very things we take to be true, the medium in which things take place. So people critique television shows rather than television, right? They critique the content rather than the vehicle transmission. And for McLuhan, and for most critical thinkers like Foucault and Derrida and me, it's the institutional practices. It's the discourse itself that is the problem, not the particular instance of some perceived ill doing. So in The Great Hack, the movie opens and we're led into the issue by a professor of media in New York, and he's talking to his classroom, and he's like, "How many of you, are on Facebook right now? How many of you ever protect your data?" Whatever. He's going through this thing, and it's supposed to be damning. And then some student in the class raises her hand and says, "Well, I don't really see the problem in having ads. They get my data, they target an ad to me. What's the nefarious part? What's so wrong?" And then all of a sudden it sort of transitions. And that's supposed to be the big reveal, is that our democracy is under siege because I can't quite tell actually why. Because it seems that somebody's using data to persuade us. And it's called, the big phrase they use towards the end of the film is this weaponized data and propaganda. And that somehow, because companies have all this information about us. They know how to persuade us. And therefore, they can tell us anything. We don't know whether it's true or not. And they push our buttons and then we vote some way. And so that's the end of democracy. There's so many problems I have with that premise. Most notably, perhaps, is it ignores the, agency of people, right? There's a sort of smugness that's always rampant in a certain liberal discourse, which is people don't know what they want. They're just the herd. We know. We need to be careful about what we say to them and do for them because they're bozos. And, they see some ads about crooked Hillary and then they vote for Trump. They didn't know better. And it's so condescending. So that's one major problem I have with the very premise of the critique that lies at the heart of this documentary, The Great Hack. It assumes people are morons, which they may or may not be, but that they don't have agency and that somebody else needs to look out for them. Legislation needs to look out for them because they don't know better. The people talking, like this journalist, she knows better. But these people just seeing ads about Hillary, they voted for Trump and they shouldn't have. The second part is that this is somehow different than what's come before, right? This is somehow different, this sort of super targeted news that can take place through Facebook ads is somehow different. And that's propaganda that's different from, let's say, something like the New York Times, the Washington Post. Those are not propaganda. Those are, they have, the virtues of a free press and they're sincere and they want to tell the truth and they fact check and that's the good stuff. And this other stuff is new and dangerous. And again, the problem there for me is that I, at 16, I knew the New York Times was propaganda, right? I remember, seeing that their tagline back when I was a kid, all the news that's fit to print, and being just sort of horrified by that, And I was like, and this whole notion that they're the newspaper of record. It's so problematic to me. I hate using that word, problematic. It's so troubling to me. I saw the New York Times for what it was, and it's not liberal bias or whatever that means. That's not my problem with it. My problem is that it is a vehicle of the institution of capitalism, whether so-called conservative or liberal. Again, that's one of the great problems I have with trying to enter public discourse is the battle people have. They think they're fighting each other, right? But the liberals and the conservatives, or whatever that even means, but they're both participating in the very same structure, the very same medium, and never considering the environment in the McLuhan sense, not in the ecological sense, in the McLuhan sense of the sort of background of the very structures that facilitate and create and foment and perpetuate the conditions of our life. And I'll get more specific as I move on here. So this film has these devastating critiques of Cambridge Analytica and Facebook and the sort of state of data in our culture. Again, the first being that people are being served data that we have to vet the kinds of things they're hearing because they're not capable of making decisions. This, which is funny because that's the very premise of fascism. And this is at sort of the point at which liberalism and fascism overlap each other. I've been made sort of aware of that through reading and talking to Thaddeus Russell and reading his great book, The Renegade History of the United States, and his chapter on the rise of the sort of New Deal and FDR and its clear sort of affiliations with, the fascists in Italy and the Nazis in Germany, right? This idea that a paternal state knows better for you and will make decisions for you. So that's one of the critiques of this film that I have of this film. And the second one then being that this is propaganda, which is different than the news. And again, at 16, I knew the New York Times was propaganda. I never believed the news. This sort of shock that comes all around this idea of fake news is so bizarre to me. Because, geez, again, once again, I the New York Times was always fake news to me, you know, because they never questioned the very premise of the things they're arguing about. You know, here's a classic example of newspapers perpetuating the institutions, the environment, without even realizing it. Police capture criminal, right, for stealing something, for theft. Well, okay. But, you know, I get that there's straight facts there, but, and our assumption is we want to catch criminals, but to me, theft is that necessarily bad? It seems our whole state apparatus is set up to defend property owners, right? So if you don't have property, it seems like you should be stealing. And why isn't the state defending you, right? It seems so bizarre to me. So that if I can't get a job and I'm starving, I don't know why the police don't help me steal from some rich motherfucker, right? But no one ever questions that. No one ever questions that property is the thing that needs to be defended and defended by the state, by our taxes, right? That's just a basic institutional issue that never comes up. It's never addressed by the press. They just perpetuate. And to me, that is propaganda. It's weaponized. Nothing, in fact, is more egregious. And insidious is better than egregious. Insidious than something like the New York Times that claims objectivity, claims fact-checking. Right? One of the beautiful things, it seems to me, about, you know, I'd never really seen any of these ads that went out around that election, around crooked Hillary, but they're sort of hilarious. They're just sort of absurd. They don't make any claims to be objective, right? Their partisan ways are just declared, and that seems more honest, less insidious than something like the New York Times or the Washington Post that take on an air, and a sanctimonious air at that, of telling you what's really happening. There are some issues that come up in this film very quickly, very tangentially, that I think are the real issues that this film is simply incapable of addressing. And that is data, and not data as the status of data, not as a human right, not as a question of privacy, which is important, but it's a different issue. And you'll see where I'm going. It's about data as an economic right, as a property right. So, you know, this one of the so-called whistleblowers from Cambridge Analytica in this film actually mentions it in passing a couple of times, and the film never follows through. I got excited for a minute. And what she says is, your data is taken by Facebook and sold, and you see no profits. It's a very strange thing, right? And it's never, we don't even talk about it. That's never the issue. We talk about privacy. We talk about what did we consent to or not consent to. But how about all that information about me, that these footprints on the internet that I leave are mine. They're mine to sell. And if that's the case, if information, as this woman in the film suggests or claims, is, you know, that information has surpassed oil as the most valuable asset, the most valuable thing in the world, right? Companies like Google and Apple and Facebook have surpassed ExxonMobil, right? And all they're dealing in is data, right? Facebook just takes your data and sells it. But why is it theirs to sell? How did that ever happen? And this film and all the debates have us talking about privacy. You can have this data, not that data. How about I'll control, each individual can control their own data and profit from it. And of course, Facebook has built a platform. They put money in, and so I don't want to cut them out. That wouldn't be fair. But they shouldn't get everything, right? They shouldn't be able to extract everything. And that, to me, is the institutional problem that this film is incapable of addressing and is the real issue, which is the centralized capitalism and capital's assumption of its right to extract value from the world without sharing it, right? So that's oil, or the whole state of the planet. It's just been devastated. It's been plummeted. It's been, destroyed. Because capitalism assumes I can just take this. This is my right, and we fight these wars. Because I can just suck that oil out of the ground and burn it, and might be devastating the planet. But that's its approach, is just relentless extraction, and then wealth concentrated to the few. So Exxon pulls it out of the ground, so they get the profit from it. I don't understand why the profits aren't shared with the country, right? It seems, again, such an obvious thing. With information, it's even more obvious. And what the information economy allows for is a radical transformation of economic structures, economic wealth, the terms of wealth distribution. Hear me out. And I want to give props to the person who turned me on to this, which is Edward Hickman, who is the CEO of a company I work with called Anatha, which is a decentralized application company. You know, builds decentralized applications along with a crypto coin to power it. But what he claims, and I think rather deftly and brilliantly, there might be many people who've claimed this, but it was a revelation to me. I couldn't believe how kind of obvious it is when you hear it, and it still had never occurred to me, which is that we live now in a kind of new resource economy. Just like the dollar used to be tethered to gold, and oil was a resource, and we used to really deal in transactions of things and, again, resources that are limited. Information is the new resource. But what's so beautiful about it is we all have it. So rather than oil being centralized in various locales, you know, Venezuela and the Middle East and Texas, we all have our information. Right? So we're all the source, and our information is ongoing. It's abundant. It's, you know, as I grow older, my information is of value to this world, of value to brands, of value to the market. And what that means is we all, as individuals, have the ability to sell our data as we see fit, and thereby create sort of vast universal prosperity, rather than the system being the system of extraction, such as Facebook's assumption that you use our app and we take all data and we keep all profits. With this other resource model, if we actually said, my data is my property and I can share it as I wish, meaning I can opt out completely, or I can opt in various ways and share in the revenue, be part of this economy. So my information and Facebook's desire to use it and sell it, they become one and the same thing. Our interests align, rather than the present model in which Facebook wants as much from me without giving me anything. Occasional some utility, but that doesn't seem like a fair trade, this utility. Right, for the amount of wealth it's generating, it just doesn't seem comparable. Right? And so in the film, this woman, I have Brittany Kaiser, I can't remember her name, she says, it's just a quick passing. I think it's even just a picture of a headline of an article she wrote, which is Facebook owes, X billions of dollars to its users for use of its data. And the film does not follow that path. The film follows the path that Cambridge Analytica was targeting ads, and that's the end of democracy. And I go, what? It's such a minor issue. I mean, what I could tell from this film is Cambridge Analytica did a fantastic job, just as Facebook has done a fantastic job of operating within a structure, within what, again, McLuhan calls an environment, within the terms of a certain kind of capitalism. It's not capitalism per se. It's a certain kind of capitalism or a certain kind of economic system. You know, maybe it's too heated to use the word capitalism. I'll stay away from that because I'm not talking about a move to socialism per se. Not that I'm opposed or favor. It's moot. What I'm saying is that if each individual's data is something that can be sold, and that we all become a kind of oil reserve, an endless oil reserve, so that we can all prosper, then we have almost a free market kind of socialism or free market abundance. That it's still a capitalism, but it's a capitalism premised not on scarcity per se, but on abundance, on collective prosperity rather than centralized, unabashed extraction. I can't tell if that's an argument that just makes sense, but to me it's so clear and clean that if we redefine our data, all the things we do, our credit card uses, all our GPS information, all the things we buy, all the things we post and like, and say that that is my information. And for participating in your platform, Facebook, Google, I'll give you some of the take. We'll share in the take. It'll be a revenue share. Now, technologically, you know, very practically, that's exceedingly complicated and sort of absurdly difficult. I mean, I'll say impossible in the present centralized technology infrastructure. And that is the promise of decentralization, one form of which, one technology, which is something called blockchain, which is a peer-to-peer decentralized technology that has these things called smart contracts, in which a smart contract is just a contract in which terms are automatically executed against, right? So you can imagine a smart contract around escrow, right? If you're in a house closing, and rather than you going and signing papers and asking the bank to do something, and then you have it notarized over here, once money was sent from one crypto wallet to another wallet, or let's just say money is sent to you, that the contract knows that. It's smart, and it automatically releases the money that's in escrow to you. Right? There's no need for all this bureaucracy. And that's one of the promises of blockchain and of the technology around cryptocurrency. But it's also makes possible is a kind of corporate structure in which I can control my data. I have this identity that's on the blockchain, and it has all my information around it. And I can interact with tons of different companies and tons of different platforms rather seamlessly and quickly to give them access to pieces of my data in exchange for money. And some of that money can just automatically, according to predetermined percentages, flow to the company. And some flows to me. And that is to me what's so exciting about a decentralized technology infrastructure is the inauguration of a decentralized economic system that is neither present-day centralized crony capitalism, which is sort of what we live in now, right? We have all the rich, you know, working at the top and rigging the system so that all capital flows to them. And we all see the issues that emerge from these sort of enormous wealth disparities that's sort of literally killing us. But rather than just simply replacing that with socialism, with another centralized body that will determine who gets money, I'm not saying I'm opposed to that. I'm not saying I'm in favor of that. I'm saying there's another model, which is an economic structure, a relationship between corporation and customer, in which the customer becomes a kind of partner, rather than an external market of shareholders who may or may not participate in the platform, right? You can own a lot of Facebook and you stock and never use Facebook, right? There's an external market. With cryptocurrency, you could have the participant in the network is a kind of shareholder, is a kind of partner. I'm creating the data. The platform gets better thanks to my data, right? We all sort of prosper just in terms of culturally, right? I share my stories with you. I get to see your kids. I get to see what you had for dinner. We get to talk about aliens and cool shit or not. But at the same time, in all that exchange, you know, brands are allowed to talk to us. People are allowed to advertise to us. But rather than all that wealth being funneled to a very a select few of shareholders and board members and, you know, fundamentally stockholders and, you know, the executive team of Facebook, all of a sudden, all that wealth that's generated is being disseminated automatically and shared according to your contribution, right? According to how much data you have and what you can sell. And to me, that just solves so many problems immediately, right? It takes on, the denial of access to the economic, to the world's economy that is so pervasive in this world. You know, most people listening to this, I assume all of you have identities and accounts and you know how to plug into to a system and get money and deal with money, pay bills, all that kind of stuff. But that's not true for a lot of the world, right? They don't have a verifiable identity to even participate in an economic system, right? This is what they call the unbanked. But now these people, thanks to decentralization, can have a confirmed identity and they have a resource. And that resource is them and their information. And that is something they can sell. So rather than having to get microloans to sell tchotchkes by the side of the road and hope they can make a few bucks to feed their kids, their very existence in the information economy means they have a value. They literally have an actual value within within the global economy that can remove them from and remove everyone from poverty. And this is what The Great Hack completely missed. In a way, it's a dangerous film because it's all these red herrings. It makes you think you're being critical. It makes you think you've accomplished something. It makes you think you have some kind of insights. It makes you think, oh my God, can you believe they did this? And thank God we took down Cambridge Analytica. But to me, I do feel sorry for Cambridge Analytica because it looks like they did a fantastic job doing their job. You know, it's the terms of the job itself that are questionable. And that's not Cambridge Analytica's fault. That's I don't know what to call it. I don't want to call it capitalism because it's not just capitalism. It's this particular form of an economic system that we exist in which, wealth is extracted from us without any sharing, without any retribution, without any recompensation. And that, to me, is the issue. All right, enough of that.